Hello and salam alaikum, and welcome back to Muslim Women Talk Ramadan with me, Shalina Jan Mohammed. We are now deep into Ramadan. How is it going for you? Yeah, those early morning suhoors, they're a bit tricky, aren't they? And I've been really struggling to sleep this year, so I'm going through the day a bit like a zombie, not knowing if it's the beginning or end. Or I have been sneaking in a little sneaky power nap. Don't tell anyone else. Let me know if you've been doing the same. We are back with your regular weekly hug, BFF, and pep talk for Ramadan. And in this episode, I can promise you, we have some absolutely sparkling chat. We have the incredible Asma Khan, who is going to be joining us as our special guest. And you will be absolutely gobsmacked at the insights she has to share about her relationship with food and Ramadan, how she uses it to give back. And she's going to talk to us about what it means to be a warrior princess. We're also going to be talking to Henrietta, our Ramadan BFF. And this week we are talking about power in the home. But first, it's time to catch up with my daughters, Hannah and Iman. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
Alaikum assalam.
And this week we're talking about power in the home. So this is where we're going to reveal all our secrets. Don't reveal all our secrets, okay?
All of them.
All of them?
All of them.
I can pay you later to keep them quiet.
Okay.
So I'm going to start with a bit of fun, as always. We're going to talk about secret and sneaky powers. Who really has the most power in the house?
You.
I think the thing that has the most power in
our... Wait. Yes. Wi-Fi.
Ooh.
Wi-Fi has more power than mummy and daddy.
Because it is addictive, like a lot.
I mean, I guess you're right, because we use it for basically everything. For work, for...
school.
Relaxing.
I'm starting to feel redundant. Right. What is a sneaky way that kids have secret power over parents?
So for little kids, like really young kids, if they're really cute,
that
experience
is
from when I was younger.
Did you used to use that power without us knowing?
I think Hannah has as well.
I mean, you are both.
She did. I've watched videos.
I did not.
with her little puppy eyes.
Do you think if you have a faith, like if you're a Muslim, that gives you a kind of power?
I think it gives you a power because I think it gives you something to focus on and like something to have, as in something to ground you.
When you have a family, there are different people in it and different people might have different kinds of power. Do you think, I mean, you're an older sister and a younger sister, do you think you have different kinds of power?
I think
definitely.
Yeah.
It depends how your power leader like you are feeling. Like if I was really mean today to the wall, for example, but Hannah was really nice to the wall, then you might think she's more important that day because she's more nice and you might give her more power.
I think the power
that day, but then the next day,
we have a power dynamic going on here right now.
The next day, Hannah was really mean to the wall, so I'm more important because I get more power because I was nicer.
I think the power dynamic is mainly just like whoever is cooking dinner that day has the most power. I think.
Well, Hannah and Iman, I encourage you to take more power by cooking the dinner in that case. Do you think being the youngest or the oldest does affect how much power you have in the family?
Yeah, definitely. But it has different power in different contexts. Because if it's someone who wanted to get what they wanted, like, depending on what it is they want, it could be a different person who has more power. So if someone wanted to, like...
get a bunch of sweets.
It's more likely going to be Iman.
The younger in the house. There is a certain power, isn't there, that you have? I mean, I sometimes think that the power of the home and the way that we can fill up almost like our batteries as people is by having love and care in the home.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you can have that you don't necessarily get outside the home. Are there ways in the home that you feel people can show love or care that you like when it's shown in the home?
Like when you're doing work or something and then someone like offers help to you. Yeah, when you're just kind of doing things like to your normal daily schedule and then someone offers to help or offers to like do something with you for a bit.
If they hug you.
You like a good hug, don't you?
If they look after you, for example, if you're really, 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 really sick.
That was a nicely timed cough. And finally, in terms of if we have that love and care in the house, and we talked about the different balances of power of who has it and the sneaky ways you use your cuteness to get us to do things. If you feel that love and respect, particularly that respect in the house, because we're the parents and you're the children, what impact does it have on you when we show respect to you?
I think it's quite big because...
I don't think it's very big, though, because I think you're always being nice and respectful. So I don't think it's that big because you're always quite nice.
That's what I was going to say to begin with.
So when you're respected, it does feel good?
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
And I think it is definitely... Not always so much like the act of respect, but more the person who is doing the act of respect.
You know, sometimes I think we make a lot of effort in our house, for example, that to tell you guys, oh, we thought something you did was really great. Or actually, if we have an opinion and you changed our mind about that opinion, that actually we really value that you were right. Or sometimes we get things wrong and we say sorry to you that if we've made a mistake. How does that make you feel?
Good, yeah, because...
I told you so.
It's nice when people acknowledge something.
Sometimes I told you so.
Like, if they acknowledge something good that you've done or they've acknowledged when they've done something wrong, it feels nice because you want that awareness about yourself.
Well, do you know what? Here's some acknowledgement for you. You both are lovely and it's such a joy having you on the podcast.
Nice being on here.
Thank you. Thank you for that, girls. I really enjoyed it. I'm hoping your coughs and sniffles are going to get better soon. During this podcast series, we have been talking about power and particularly women's power. And this week, I'm really excited to talk about something that's really important to us and feels very, very immediate in Ramadan, which is power in the home. And what should women be doing in the home to assert that power? And to talk us through that, we have the fabulous Henrietta Sovati. Salaam alaikum, Henrietta.
Wa alaikum salaam.
We are in the depths of Ramadan now, and we're with our families, we're in the households, we're spending a lot of time with them. And that home is somewhere that all of us spend a lot of time in, particularly in the post-lockdown and post-pandemic years. And it's typically seen as the place where women wield their power. In Arabic, we have this term, Rabbatul Bayt, the master, the queen of the house. But what do we mean when we talk about power in the home?
It's a very intriguing and interesting question because there are certain cultural and religious messages that come around that the women are the heart of the home and they are the homemakers and they are the ones who move the family around. But we also know that Islam as a tradition allows for individual expression too. So my take on this is I believe it's based on strength and choice. So whatever the homemaker role is, if and when the woman's strength is homemaking and running the home, and she chooses to do so, and we need to really be careful because these are two parallel requests, she has to be strong and she has to choose that role. Whereas we know that a lot of conflict comes from that they have the strength but they don't choose it, or they don't have the strength and they don't have the choice either, but they are expected to run. And especially in Ramadan, you know, all the requests that we get from Ramadan. I believe Ramadan is a family affair. Women can lead, but it doesn't mean that women have to do everything. Women don't have to be responsible for every single little Instagram post looking table or all the tiny little details. But I do believe that if women have the strength and the choice to do it, then she should lead it. But it's, again, I'm focusing on the strength and the choice because very often when one of them is missing, that's where we kind of go off the rail and we really are not feeling that I am, you know, really running my home well.
I do wonder if you're talking about a mismatch of this glorification of women's power in the household, putting on a pedestal. But the reality is maybe she doesn't have as much power in the house as is described, or maybe she doesn't take as much power. Is there a tension between when you're leading, do you do all the work as well? Because power does imply that there are other people involved if we talk about a traditional sense of power.
Yes, absolutely. And it's down to leadership qualities, isn't it? It's about, are we the leaders and what kind of leaders are we within our home? So, for example, you know, we live in a time where one salary is not enough anymore to survive, in particular if you live in a big city where expenses are high. So if both of the spouses, both of them are at work, who is going to take responsibility for the children? You know, all sorts of different dynamics come in, and how do you negotiate those things? There are situations today where some women earn more than the husband. How do you negotiate power in that scenario? Who pays the mortgage? Who pays the bills? You know, there are lots of different elements come in. And I believe, because in relationships and in marriages or in any living situation, you negotiate based on your individual preferences and your individual circumstances.
I was just thinking back to episode 2, we were talking about the power struggle as something to eliminate once you can establish your dignity and your own act of power. But I want to broaden out those roles that women play in the home, because there isn't just the wife, there isn't just the mother. There are many roles that women play in the home. The daughter, the daughter-in-law, the sister, could be an aunt or a cousin. How does power show up in those different kinds of roles? And what should we be looking for when we're playing one of those roles, which are important roles in society?
So I think we touched upon in a previous episode about this centered self, this aligned centered self. And I mentioned this because any of those roles, wherever we go, we should not change who we are. We shouldn't be acting. We shouldn't be inauthentic. We shouldn't be intransparent. We should be really our centered self and being able to navigate those relationships based on what those new relationships are required of us. And I think it's that question of, I am the same person with every single person within my family. Am I going to be different when I go to work? What is changing? Am I going to be a completely different person when I enter the boardroom? Do I become a dragon when I'm leading at work? And unfortunately, sometimes that's what happens to women, is that I have had this experience that women at home feel relatively powerless, unseen, invisible, but they have a very powerful job. So when they go to work, they act out and they lash out all their energies that they can't practice at home, they do it at work. And the other way around, there are people who are unseen and invisible at work, but when they go home, suddenly they have to run the show and they have to be even more powerful than what they naturally would be. So there's a compensation happening. And I think it's really important that we think about this, that when you have a practice to be, I am okay, I'm centered, and this is okay with me, it doesn't really matter where we are. We can navigate all those from this core strength, from this core essence of who we are, and it's part of my purpose, it's part of my alignment. So we don't have to act, we don't have to pretend, we don't have to become different people, but we can be our authentic self in most places wherever we show up.
So here's the million-dollar question.
You always have one of those.
Or the Laylatul Qadr question. How do I create that centering in my power? Where does it come from and how do I instill it inside me?
I would love to do this little exercise with all of us, but I just want to give us all a reminder and invite you to really think about the centered self in four dimensions. The centering self on length, which is navigated and focused around the length, which is the position of dignity. Everybody was born with dignity. So that place of dignity. The second, which everybody wants, is connection. And that's our width. That's our, from side to side of our body. The third one, which is wisdom, which is our back body. What's behind us, where we come from, what values we are born with, you know, what are the values we manifest, what are the beliefs that we learn from our families, who were our teachers, our mentors. So all that wisdom that comes with us. And the fourth is our very, very core center of, what do I care about? What is my purpose? Why am I here? In any situation, you might ask yourself, why am I in this gathering, in this family gathering? What's my purpose to be here? And that centered self, as you practice more and more, your tissues are going to absorb this idea that wherever you go, dignity, connection, wisdom, and your purpose is always with you.
I want to talk a little bit about culture, and people listening will be coming from many different kinds of cultures. For me, growing up as a South Asian, East African, British woman, there are lots of dimensions of culture that come into play. How does culture affect the hierarchy, the structure of power within a house? But side by side with that, I always think about when you create a household and you have a family, it's like you've created an entirely new and unique culture that's not the same as your parents' house. It's not the same as your in-laws' house. It's not the same as your brother or sister's house. It's a unique culture. So how can we navigate the external cultures that have ideas about hierarchy alongside creating a culture where, I don't know, how would you describe it, that power is more distributed, that people can exist in their own power? How do we manage those two different, almost conflicting types of power?
So I am married to someone from an Asian culture. I am European. I grew up without Islam until I was 26. So you can imagine the mix of what happens in our house when it comes to certain things. And also, while I appreciate a lot of things about Asian culture, there are things that I find difficult. And I think there are women, Asian women, who find things difficult within the culture. And for me, really the guidepost around this is going back to this question of, what am I responsible for? And as you said, within our own household, we are responsible for what we create. And how much involvement do I want from my in-laws? How much involvement do I want from other members of the family? Am I requested to move into extended family situation? I lived with extended family situation as well, so I have that experience. But I think it always comes back to, what is a sustainable practice and a sustainable way to keep the relationship? Because you can never say no to family, of course. But within that, you still have to think about boundaries. There are going to be things that have to be discussed, and it's going to be hard. But if you don't, you risk of not having any relationship at all. So I think it's that very delicate navigation of, I need to be clear about my boundaries, and I need to see where I need to move a little bit, perhaps, and where they need to move a little bit, or where they need to move back. So it's that very, very tender and very delicate situation, I understand, in most families, perhaps even Arab cultures and many other cultures, where extended family scenarios can bring up really big and difficult conversations for people.
I think every culture has an idea about the hierarchy that should exist within a home, and who is powerful and who is following, who's the leader, who's just carrying out that person's wishes. And of course, that varies by individual household too. Before I come to the practical task, because I love having something where we can put into action how we create power in ourselves, I want to ask almost the opposite question, because we live in a time where it can feel like what goes on in the home is not so important, less valuable. We live in a time where caring, childcare, nurturing, nourishing are not seen as powerful and are seen almost as second-class activities, often because they're considered women's work, and women's work is often very devalued. But that doesn't mean that as women we don't find that important, that we don't love it, that we don't think there is real value in it. Help us to find a way where we can reassert that these are powerful things and fall in love with them again in a society that too often tells us that they're actually not valuable things to do.
When someone is given a particular role, none of these roles are going to last forever. Everything is constantly changing, and these things are not static. We should always be making an effort to reevaluate ourselves or what we go through. So if, for example, I'm at a stage where my children are young, my responsibility is to take that role with the greatest grace and the greatest joy that I can take of it, because I know it's not going to last. And now my children are grown up. One of them is an adult, the other one is a really late teen. And everything that we do is constantly going to change. So we have to honor every single period in our lives to be able to say that I have done my best, and I know it's going to change, and I have to move, and I have to change. And just like someone was given the breadwinner's role from the beginning of the marriage, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be the case all the time, because things are changing and moving. And I think it's about having the variety of experiences But we'd always bear in mind that whatever experience we have, we need to nourish it, we need to cherish it, because it's not going to last for long. It's like when people are looking after elderly parents, for example, as hard as it is not going to last forever, but the more love and care and attention is put into it, the more you can actually enjoy it. And then I know people who feel deeply, deeply grateful that they could do this for their parents. And I'm looking forward to doing that for my mother, because that's probably going to be the case in our family. Again, we have to be awake. We have to be conscious that whatever I'm doing right now, this is what Allah has given me. And my responsibility is to respond to it with the most grace, with the most compassion, with the most diligent way of doing what I'm requested to do.
I can certainly resonate with your discussion about caring for parents, which listeners will know I did for several years for my own. And that exercise of power over somebody who's entirely dependent on you while you're trying to preserve their dignity because they're grown-ups, looking after somebody older than you is very different to looking after a child.
Yes.
Because you have to preserve their sense of self while having that power to entirely shape their lives is a very, very humbling experience. Now, we've been talking in this episode about the home, women's power in the home and in that wider family, for example, looking after parents. What can you give us to go away and practically try as a way to practice power in the home?
I was actually thinking about our listeners this week, and I thought it would be a fabulous idea to look at what works in my family, where am I falling short, and where are others falling short, and have a bit of reflection around what needs changing. And instead of me doing all the work to make it the perfect Ramadan, how can I delegate? And what do I need to delegate so us as a family can make the rest of Ramadan special and unique and very individual to us as a family?
So observing how it's working in our house, and I think we can all get on board with delegating some of that work to other people to reclaim our power. Henrietta, thank you for talking to us about women's power and in the home and giving us some homework to try it out.
Thank you.
Now, one of my favourite parts of this, I know I say this about every bit of the episode, but I really do love the next bit, which is hearing voices from all of you, the Muslim women around the world who are listening to this podcast every week. And believe me, you are listening from all around the world. Hello to people from Jordan, Uzbekistan, Senegal, the USA, the UK, and actually pretty much every country. So we are gathering your voices and getting our listenership out across the world to Muslim women wherever you are. So this week, we asked about what does power in the home mean to you?
Power in the home to me looks like harmony, sounds like harmony, and feels like harmony.
I see power in the home as deeply rooted in Tawheed and built on a foundation of love, respect, and appreciation.
It's important to have power at home. Well, because it's your home, your sanctuary. It's where you should feel safe and at peace.
The greatest challenge to power in the home is the act of self-sacrifice. Raising a family requires a level of selflessness that at times can blur your sense of identity, purpose, and direction. The constant giving, emotionally, mentally, and physically, can leave little room for personal aspirations, leading to moments of feeling lost in the very space that you nurture.
One of the barriers is misunderstanding, and the other could be willful ignorance. I think it is to shy away from having the harder conversations and space holding that we both would need in a relationship or a home.
Power in the home is not about dominance, but balance, and finding that balance between duty to others and duty to oneself can often feel like an uphill battle.
It is crucial for a Muslim woman to recognize her power within the home, as she plays a vital role in fostering strong family relationships and happiness. Most importantly, Allah has honored her with specific rights, but it is her responsibility to uphold and protect them. By doing so, she not only safeguards her well-being, but also contributes to the overall success and harmony of the household.
Thank you so much for those amazing and powerful messages. And you can send me your voice notes on women and power to my social handles, Love in a Headscarf or Shalina Jan Muhammad. In this week's episode, I told you that I couldn't be more excited about our guest, and the moment is finally here. You can't see that I'm jumping up and down in my seat, but we are talking this week to Asma Khan. She is an award-winning chef, restaurateur, and author, known not just for her culinary expertise, but also for her commitment to empowering women. She started her journey with supper clubs in the home and then founded the celebrated London restaurant Darjeeling Express, famous for both its flavours as well as its all-female kitchen team. She was the first British chef featured on the hit Netflix series Chef's Table, and her latest book called Monsoon was published just last week, and she also has a new TV series called Secrets of the Curry Kitchen. Salaam alaikum, Asma, and welcome.
Wa alaikum salaam. Thank you very much for having me on your podcast.
How is Ramadan going for you?
Surprisingly, really well. I always get nervous. I also get excited. I wait for Ramadan to come. And then I'm terrified that I'm going to break my fast by mistake. Because unlike other people who are not surrounded by food, I am. And in a kitchen, you know how the instinct is to taste and check things and pick up things as you walk in and out of the kitchen. So far, I have not done that. I'm very proud of myself. It's going really well. Alhamdulillah.
Now I'm going to start with a few quick fire questions, which I ask all of our guests. So just quick little answers. What do you love about Ramadan?
I love suhoor. Since my older son has started fasting with me, I actually find that the most magical point because he always makes me suhoor. And that role reversal of being nurtured and cared for at a time in my life when I'm still healthy and, you know, not old, that happens with children, you know, when they come in and look after you when you are unwell. That, mashallah, in my health, my son takes care of me and makes suhoor. And, you know, it's very silent. And I think that is what is my most favorite part.
What do you find challenging?
This, what I've mentioned before, the fact that I'm always scared I'm going to end up eating by mistake and forgetting that I'm fasting. Also, it's unlike, you know, in the past where it was very long or where in India where it was very hot. You're very aware that you were fasting because you were so thirsty from like 10 o'clock in the morning. It feels quite normal. So you can forget sometimes. I'm scared I'm going to pick up food and eat it by mistake.
And why is Ramadan important to you?
The most important thing of Ramadan, I think, is that, you know, it reminds you of your privilege. It's not just the food and drink. It's just this time when you know that your prayers count and that you have this time for looking deep into your soul and remembering all the kind of things that you need to be grateful for. So this is what makes Ramadan so special.
I want to take you back to your childhood, and you've talked about yourself as a warrior, which is not a word that women often use to describe themselves, let alone when they were children. What happened to you that you felt that this was the archetype for you, and how has that shaped your life?
I think it was because I felt very marginalized and isolated and on the fringe of my extended family in the clan. It was really because I didn't fit in. I was so different. I was laughed at by a lot of kind of distant relatives and some not so distant relatives because of the fact that I was fat, I was dark, I wasn't like as graceful and as beautiful as all the girls in my family who all look like princesses, who still look like princesses and who love to dress up. And I hated dressing up. I would not wear heels. I loved to play cricket. I was often out in the sun playing on the street. I was a tomboy. So the fact that, you know, I was this outsider, but it made a huge difference that the person who everybody loved, my own sister, who, you know, still looks 10 years younger than me, although she's older and looks like a complete model even now, told me that I was the warrior princess, that the world would shake one day around me, that I would make this big difference, the world would know my name. She gave me the confidence, and this was a game changer. I was only 4, and because I know the age, because my brother had just been born, I understood what solidarity means. When someone who is perceived by everybody to be powerful puts their arm around you and says, you're going to be me, you're going to be more greater than me, and believes in you, it changed my life. And the reason why I do what I do today is not because it's just a good idea or it's just a PR exercise. It's not. It's my lived experience. Because from that age, from a very young age, I felt like a warrior because she told me I was one. And I believed her. And then I saw the world differently. It just transformed everything.
A lot of the work, including the all-women kitchen team that you have, is seeming to be driven by that. And everything I observe about you is not really about yourself. It's about taking women with you. Talk to us a little bit more about how you do that and what drives it.
This what happened in my childhood, and then I took it more ahead because I realized one thing, that it doesn't dim my light. It's like this candle, you know, the candle can light many candles. That I was surrounded by women who I could see once they got a position of power, closed the door, threw away the ladder. And, you know, I'm absolutely sure that there is a tandoor in hell with chili paste for all those women. They will all be made into kebab when they die. Because it's unacceptable. If you are powerful and you have doors that you can open, you should use that to lift others up. I cannot breathe. I cannot live. I cannot enjoy anything good in my life if I know there are women in chains around me. How am I powerful then? How am I a leader? I don't deserve it. And, you know, my father always used to tell me this, that, you know, come out, and he used to listen, make me listen to the bird in the darkness before dawn. Abba used to tell me, you're that bird that is calling out and singing. In the darkness, it is telling everybody else, Allah is bringing light. There is dawn going to come. You have to be that when you grow up. My father has been inspirational. And, you know, we need to tell our girls this. We need to tell our boys this as well. That, you know, be that bird that sings of light, that tells people there is hope in the darkness, because they are confident and secure on their branch. They know, they believe. And I think that that is really what is driving me.
Do you see food, and you give away a lot of food in Ramadan, you pack iftars and you send them to the local hospital and you support the Ramadan Tent Project. And I'm sure there's a lot going on that we also don't know about. Do you see food as your way of giving to people?
Yes, I do see food as a way of giving back, but very focused in the month of Ramadan, where a lot of people are not eating from sunrise to sunset, because this is their journey of spirituality. But having worked in refugee camps, working in war zones, going into places with natural calamities, I know one thing, that sunrise and sunset is meaningless. When the sun sets, there is still hunger. The water is so dangerous, it's going to make you sick, and you may not even have access to clean water. And this idea that, you know, iftar, which for many households, you have a table groaning with food. I understand one thing, that it is deeply humbling to have those options, that you feel, I've been a good Muslim, I've been a good person, I have fasted. That there are people around us, even in our midst, in this country, where they are struggling to eat, struggling to have good food. And I think that that's why this month, apart from, you know, giving out food to those who I know are giving to others and not being able to eat good meals, we even feed the homeless who are, you know, of any faith or no faith, who also may have addictions from alcoholism to drugs. I will not judge them. For me, hunger is hunger. I will feed everybody. I will judge no one, because I understand one thing, that I have, mashallah, the gift to cook. I have the ability to do this. This is my calling. This is my month where I can bow down. It is my sijda to Allah, because I feel by doing this, I spread the goodness that, you know, the barakat that I've had, and I want to spread it as far and wide as I can without judgment.
That image that you painted of the groaning iftar table that, you know, fills our Instagram feeds and it's our photos and almost the expectation on women, I think can often have a really troubled relationship for women in Ramadan. We know from all the studies that women are cooking the vast majority of iftar meals, if not nearly all of them. And now that the time is earlier, there'll be a big late night meal, not to mention suhoor. I mean, what was your experience of that before you became a chef? And has it changed now that you're in the kitchen and you're like next level trying to do iftar for everybody? I think that relationship between women and iftar is happy and stressful.
Yes, and I think the expectation that the female will be the nourisher and the provider. I say this often, you know, women eat last and they eat least. This thing of providing for everybody, and they are responsible for the iftar. I know very few men who actually make iftar. I mean, my son is probably an exception. And it does leave women with this expectation. It is another burden that they are carrying, and they make it look effortless. Women make everything look effortless. And this is why I often say people think it's meaningless, that is valueless, because no one will step in and even, you know, carry the food in and offer to wash the plates. It is in every culture, you know. So I grew up in India. I saw it there. My mother, you know, running around like crazy, trying to get all the iftar, and nobody was getting up. And, you know, yes, we did have servants to help us, but it was almost like my mother's responsibility to make sure that there was at least 10 dishes on the table, that everyone's favorite was on the table. And if, God forbid, it was not on the table, she spent the whole iftar apologizing that, you know, this was not there and you wanted it. And why she felt that there was this expectation on her. It is so unfair that that is how we expect women to deliver. But it is a manifestation of how we see women generally. What is happening in Ramadan is what is happening in life every day. It hurts more because you know that women are also fasting. They also need some level of support. And it is exhausting because many are also doing other things, just like men. But somehow we don't give them a pass.
I need to just fly the flag for my husband, who is also cooking iftar and doing the suhoor meal with the kids. So just to say, there are some good ones out there.
Yes, there are.
But you talked about something really interesting, which was that women are almost like apologizing even when they're doing really great stuff. I mean, to provide any kind of meal, let alone an iftar, but then to apologize just feels a really problematic place that we are in as women. And you're right, it comes up much more in Ramadan because I think all the spotlight is on us. I mean, do you find yourself, I can't imagine you're apologizing for yourself, but do you do that? How do you overcome it?
I do apologize. I always feel that I'm continuously failing as a mother, as a wife. I'm tormented often with this idea that I'm not good enough. I'm saying this so that everybody who's listening to this can say this too. It's okay. You do not need to be perfect. And you can fail. But there's some things that you've achieved. And it's really hard when you're a mother and you're trying to balance, you know, motherhood and professional work and other things that are happening. And, you know, looking after your elderly parents, taking care of in-laws or other things. And you're spinning so many plates. It is almost like, you know, you should not be even talking about this. It should make it look effortless. Why? And I also think that women are not kind to other women. We do not give them spaces. So thank you very much for having me on your podcast. I think this, I'm really grateful because what you're doing is very significant. You're giving a platform to women to express views that so many other women have. But if you hear someone else saying it, it validates your own insecurities, it validates your fears and what you're going through. And we need more women to have spaces where they can hear other women saying things that they are feeling.
Well, thank you for those. I mean, those heartfelt words about your own experiences. I think when we look at somebody who's achieved all the things that you've achieved, and may you go on to achieve many more, it makes us realise that those doubts that we have in us are valid in a way, and that we're not the only ones struggling with them. And thank you also for your kind words of support for what we're trying to do with this conversation and this podcast. That really means a lot, because sometimes it feels like you're doing it in a dark room and just like throwing it out there and hoping it's going to land.
It does. And I think that, you know, the big problem is that everybody is living in the world of social media where there are filtered images of success. And for all of us who are doing things behind the scenes, it's like what you said, you know, in a dark room, in a dark space, you know, just throwing stuff out and you're not showing where the image, you know, where actually it's impacting. Please do it, because the thing is that what you see in social media is the tip of the iceberg. You're not seeing all the hard work behind, and you feel that everyone gets this immediate reward, you know, immediate praise, immediate success. It doesn't work that way. And one of the most powerful things I heard was from Tom Daly, who was a diver. We met at Davos and we were having this conversation, and he said, "You worked for 4 years as a diver for 6 dives, and they have to be perfect. That's your medal option." How frightening is that? But then you see this person with a gold medal, you think, wow, you know, he's a great success. And there are people who are doing this around us. We just see them when they are with their medal and on a podium. He really made me understand. He trained for 4 years, had to eat a restricted diet, had to work so hard and deal with all his body image things because, you know, as a diver, you're literally wearing nothing when you're going on to dive. And yet then people then judge, oh, it was only a silver or it was only a bronze. You didn't get gold. It's crazy. We are this crazy society which is constantly forcing people into these really dark spaces by judging them. Stop doing it.
That sense of kind of being in the dark space and waiting and doing all the hard work before you get the moment in the spotlight. But that moment in the spotlight is quite important too in terms of making space for yourself in the public narrative, in the public consciousness. And one of the things that's always inspired me is the way you talk about having your presence felt being important to be seen as a woman, as an immigrant, as a Muslim woman, impacting culture. What are your secrets or failures possibly in making space for yourself as a woman out there?
Well, for one thing is that I believed in myself. I'm also unafraid. I do not compare myself to anyone. The problem is that there's a lot of pressure to be competitive, to compare yourself. I absolutely, clearly, 100% can tell you one thing. I run a solo race. I'm not competing with anyone. I hold on to my faith, to my family, as my anchor. Then I run. I do not look to see who else is there. This has made me, what I am. I recognize the fact that I have opportunities. I have had accolades. I've had, really kind of great success. And I'm, alhamdulillah, very grateful for that. But I know this is because I did not allow anyone else to get on my ship and tell me where to go. I wrote my own story. Every day, I live one day less. This is not my dress rehearsal. I'm completely sure that these are chances that I'm getting, opportunities that I get. You know, even the king's visit. It's not, someone asked me, did you invite the king? I said, am I mad? Of course not. I've never seen the king going to a restaurant or even entering a restaurant kitchen, even his mother before that. Why would I even think of inviting the king? They approached me. And I immediately thought, who else can I bring on stage? Who else can I open this opportunity to? That was my first instinct. Apart from the first panic that, oh my God, I'm going to paint my restaurant. And what am I going to do? And what am I going to wear? Then I thought, who am I going to bring? Who am I going to invite? So that it becomes about us and not me. You have to think beyond yourself. Otherwise, you are getting into a vortex of darkness by being so obsessed about your own personal success. And when that success comes, open up your heart and bring other people on board, because it will make it an easier place. It will be less lonely. There'll be more smiles and there will be celebration because you've done something for other people. It's a great feeling. Try it.
For those who are listening who don't know, the King and Queen just kind of swung past Asma's restaurant in Carnaby Street and actually helped to come and pack some of the dates for the iftar that Asma sends out. So that was quite, and I think that clip went viral. So all around the world,
yes,
you've had your work and your restaurant be in front of people's faces, which is absolutely incredible. And I think you talk about it as you just wait and it comes to you because, if Allah opens the door, why are you worried for it? That's power in public, but I just want to spend a second talking about power in the home and whether you feel you have the power or what those power dynamics are for women in their homes.
Well, the interesting thing is that, you look at the persona of who I am in public. At home, I'm pretty much the housewife. I don't think I've changed much. I'm not necessarily the person making decisions. When you have grown-up children, you'll understand that. They have opinions and there's pushback on everything. Even the cat rules over me. So forget about the family. I don't necessarily feel very powerful. In some ways, I don't think anything has changed at all from when I got married and came to this country, which may surprise some people. But I also think that, these are personal relationships. My husband is out of the limelight and I respect him a lot because when I needed money, he gave me £185,000, his entire life savings, and helped me open a restaurant. But my God, he's been incredible because he's never interfered. He doesn't want, me to be grateful to him all the time. So he normalized this thing by giving me the money and making me not feel every day. And when disasters happened, like I told you so, he's an economist. He gives me no economic, you know, advice or advice on my what's happening in my finances. Even when I ask him for stuff, he says, listen, I trust your instincts, just go for it. So it's not that there's an unequal relationship. The relationship we had in the beginning is still that same relationship. You have to find that way of dividing your personal life and your professional life. If you're still this public persona when you come home, it can be a problem for your family because you're still the wife, the mother, the cat mother, you know, responsible for things that happen. I'm still the daughter-in-law. I'm still the daughter. I don't think that, you know, you should change all of that, but that's my opinion. It's worked for me. I want to keep something normal because I don't say this very often and I will say it now. What happened to me in my professional life is unprecedented. Overnight, I became this name everybody knew. I had superstars, you know, big people coming to my restaurant. I had the king coming to my restaurant last week. Things happen to me that don't happen to other people. But when I come home, it's the same kind of, you know, situation. And I'm grateful because I think that has just kept me rooted and kept me, you know, I am Asma. When I come home, I am Mama and I am just an ordinary person that I was before. And I like that.
I have a final question for you. What for you is the power of women?
Power of women is really their patience. We do not recognize that we are incredible human beings. I see women around me who are patient, who give so much of themselves to others, and who also expect so little back. Women are unbelievable. I know they say, you know, we're half the world, that, you know, we hold up the sky. I think that we are more than that. And I deep admiration of so many women around me, from the women who are struggling in refugee camps to women in powerful corporate jobs who still, when they come home, need to make roti for their family. And they do it. We are all being able to deal with different things. And I think that the patience of women that I see in so many women, not necessarily every woman, but I see this in so many women, I admire them so much. I have so much respect for them.
Asma, I could talk to you forever. And whenever I do, I feel like my energy levels rise and the sun is shining on me. But I know you have books to launch and TV series to run and restaurants and family as well, of course. So thank you so much for sharing your time with us today and your wisdom. We wish you all of the barakah for the rest of Ramadan and in all you do. And yeah, I'll be sending an email for my invitation at your restaurant.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Wasn't that an incredible interview with Asma? I was hanging on every word. They were like little gems just dropping from her mouth. And I don't know how we're going to choose the social media clip for this week. I feel like we just need to release the whole thing. So if you've listened and you've enjoyed it, share it with others because then they can share in that experience with Asma and all of her wisdom. I've got a lot to think about this week after hearing Asma and Henrietta and of course Hannah and Iman. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. You can go back and listen to the previous ones from this series or even last year if you want more inspiration. And I cannot wait to speak to you again next time.